This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's doing well. I just want to mention a couple things before we get into this part two with Thomas Millison and I. I really want clients to take a larger approach or a bigger, have kind of more of an open mind. I had a client recently that grew up in the 60s and 70s. He was under the typical constraints of the conventional agriculture system. And I said, those systems limit energy based on inputs. And if you're going to rely on inputs, meaning synthetic fertilizer, et cetera, you are relying on a system that's broken. It's an open system. We want a closed loop system where the system itself is functioning. And he kind of looked at me with, a couple heads and said, well, what are you talking about? And under these conditions, photosynthetic output is constrained by the lack of nutrients and microbiology. And in instances where we're dealing with temperature extremes, compacted soils, I have really cloudy environments here, you're limiting oxygen exchange within the soil, within the plant, and reduced microbial diversity and more. Those are the things that are limiting our biological activity, constraining the ability to produce these really lipid-rich microbial biomass. I'm putting together the habitat packet for my Habitat Day come out up here on July 18th. And I really want people to take a broader view of soil function. Understand that soil health discussions that we've had and I've had has matured over time. And we really want to emphasize on microbial diversity, soil aggregation, carbon cycling, and overall resilience, whether it's plant resilience or soil resilience. And, concepts around microbiology, cyanobacteria, microalgae, those are some of the quiet functions within the soil. They actually produce a really rich carbon energy reserve output that the microbiology and the plants can use. And so there are ways to fix the system, and it's a cascading effects. The plant produces something, it functions in a certain way, and the output is simply a lot of leaves, a lot of leaf matter that attracts animals. And I always say this, again, pushing the discussion here is, quality plants that are nutrient dense are going to attract quality animals. You will have a better outcome, better forage quality, better interests, better health, better vitality of the animals that you're going after if you produce good plants in the landscape. All right, well, here's part two with Thomas Mills and I. Thanks.
Should probably be careful. There might be some legal sides to this. So where legal, I put a couple scoops of mineral, this is a trace mineral in there.
Yeah.
To increase the salt content in the water, which drops the freezing point a little bit. So, and I do that late in the summertime. Even a lot of times what I'll end up doing is I'll have a little bit in my pack if I go hunt that area a couple weeks before it's going to freeze or a week before it's going to freeze. So I ensure that that's in there. And what that'll do is it'll drop that freezing point. So when you get those first frosty days of the fall and every puddle on the landscape is froze over, that pond stays open. And those
so
deer.
What you think, do you think in my liner pool, my swimming pool, do you think I should have a salt water hole?
Off to the side? No. The hot springs or something? I don't know that you would want to increase the salinity in the whole thing.
Right? No, you don't.
You run the math on that. You do a lot.
We have brine pools here. So in where I live, there's they used to make soda ash, and they used to take the salt brine out of here, out of these basins, these valleys, literally just below my property. It was a place called LA Chemical back in the day. And those brine pools are still there. They're nice. Big salt basin pools. They don't freeze in the wintertime. But to your point, it's interesting, keeping, maybe you have heat coils. I don't know what people are starting to do. But the need for water has a tendency to increase later in the season as you start to get into those cold months. Well, and that's really where the high demand periods are.
Yeah, for sure. Because you know what? During the growing season, when things are green, I think they say deer get like 75 to 85% of their moisture intake through vegetation. So obviously once things desiccate and dry down, there's less moisture available for them. And they probably need, you know, more water intake to help digest the more woody vegetation and all the things that come with it. So, I mean, I've got, again, I love these earth ponds. It's not a sales pitch. I just really love the convenience and how, and I think the biggest thing to me, and we can all, you know, as land managers, I think we all agree, you know, like that's the gratification, more instant gratification that comes like, oh, you plant a food plot, you watch it grow, you watch the deer feed on it. These earth ponds. And the second to that would be the mushroom food plots with how fast they develop and how fast the deer take to them. But those earth ponds, you drop them in the ground and usually within 24 hours or less, I mean, usually within 2 hours, you have a doe that comes sniffing around and drinks out of it. But the deer take to them so fast, they can walk down in them. Within a couple of years, there's moss growing on them. You know, it's, there's a lot of things there, but I was going to say behind my house here, I have one of the smaller earth ponds, or I think technically it's a medium, like a 50 gallon. And I taped pipe heating cable, 35 feet of pipe heating cable to the bottom of it. And then I flipped it upside down and I taped the pipe heating cable to it. And then I laid a garbage bag over the top. And then I put a layer of spray foam, like a Great Stuff insulation on it. Yeah. And then once that dried, I took that out and I sunk it in the ground back there. It is exactly a 100 foot extension cord distance from my back deck. And the very first year I put that in, my son and I put it in. When was it? It was like December 23rd or something. The ground was frozen. I'd use a pick to break through like the top couple inches of frost. And then it was soft after that. But we got that in. And on January 29th or 30th, it was like 3 days before the end of the archery season here. We were sitting in the kitchen. I'll never forget it because my daughter was really little at the time. And she, you know, in a cute little girl voice, you know, she's like, "Dad, deer." And I look out the window. I was like, "Oh yeah, there's deer." Like, "Oh, there's a nice buck, like 145 inch 10 pointer was bumping does back there 2 hours before dark. Cause it's kind of tucked up in the woods. And sure enough, he comes right down and drinks out of that water hole. And I'm standing in the kitchen. I look left. I can see the garage door and my bow's hanging on the wall right there. That's my daily reminder to practice. I see the bow. I look right. I see the kids sitting by the patio door, staring at these deer, just enjoying it. And I thought to myself, like, I still have a tag in my pocket. I was like, I could shoot this deer or I can just enjoy it. Right. So I just kept the patio door shut. So the dogs didn't get riled up. Didn't try and make any moves. And for like 20 minutes, we watched that buck bump these does around and go back and drink out of that water hole a couple different times. So I was like, that would not have happened. He wasn't there for that water hole. But he would have not have circled back to that water hole had that water resource not been available at that time. And then after that, I was like, well, we're definitely going to keep a water hole in the backyard. So it's like, you know, and I've actually had those in plans. And I've done a couple other similar versions of it for clients where they've got a cabin that's kind of tucked back in the woods. And like, this is a perfect situation for this. Perfect situation because you can run a garden hose out there to fill it up in the wintertime. You know, you're going to have to refill it because it's the only available water source around. So you're going to have to refill it, but you can run a hose out there and fill it up pretty quickly. You can see it from your cabin and, hey, I'm not going to judge you if you want to shoot a deer off the back deck of your cabin. Like, I'm not that guy.
No, so, not at all.
I think it's just cool, but it's a wildlife water hole, right?
There's a lot of points in everything you just mentioned. One, I think about back in the day, we had these, you know, these small little bird troughs, whatever you want to call them, bird baths. They were heated. That's a pretty popular kind of activity. And you see their use throughout the entire year is like exponentially high. You know, this all brought like, and I think I want to focus on this point really quickly here at the end. And I think this is important, is location. Finding the correct location to some of these examples is critical. One thing that I've kind of employed with clients is thinking about behavioral ecology, understanding the fear landscape factor that kind of comes with predation, landscape predictability, human interaction with animals, like all the things that impact animals. You made a lot of kind of remarks around being smart about intrusion in that example earlier. And so part of this is placement, finding the correct placement of these water locations where they might need to be accessible from a human maintenance standpoint, but if they're not designed correctly, or they're designed in a way where they fill themselves up, they're taking advantage of the water conditions locally, rain, et cetera, runoff, maybe those have to be in certain locations because of the deer's behavior, such that they don't want to expose themselves to open places. When I see water holes in open places, all I think is a death trap.
Mm-hmm.
And in our areas where we have low population, high hunter engagement or human engagement in these situations, and that relates to some individual point of attraction, meaning a water hole in this example, that might not have as much value in those scenarios. It may need to be placed further into, maybe even co-locate it with a bedding area, maybe within a bedding area, so to speak. And so how do you balance placement, the behavioral ecology of animals around that, human interaction? Like, maybe talk about like your theory in that, because I think it's kind of like a compounding issue.
Yeah, for sure. And that's where, you know, placement wise, again, I'm looking at adding some level of attraction in accessible areas, you know, or we have this like dynamite pinch point that we have to figure out how we can get access to, which oftentimes requires, I guess, for a lack of better term, reducing the quality of other areas of the property, right? Like, we have to reduce the attractiveness, reduce the value of that area so that we don't attract deer to it, so we can slip in and out of that location. You know, in some properties, a lot of properties unfortunately have areas like that. Most of the properties are like that. You know, like, oh, a pine plantation, for example, the property I was just on this week in eastern Wisconsin, pretty big property, really good access, deep, you know, it was fun. They're great clients, but it's a fun situation. It's a whole family. You've got a father that owns the original home farm, and then one son bought a chunk next to it that adjoins it, and the other son bought a chunk north of it that adjoins it. And it's really cool. They call it the compound, right? But it's cool. They've got a lot of access, but they still have the issues that they have are that the ground is relatively flat there. So using vegetation is huge, but there's a couple old pine tree plantation style plantings on there that are kind of deer deserts, so we can utilize those. They've got an excess of switchgrass planted on the property already, which we discussed on decreasing the amount of switchgrass, stuff like that. But, you know, those are the things that you have to accommodate. But as far as the water hole goes, again, I rarely, and this is where, you know, full disclosure, I am a dealer for a lot of products that I put in on client properties. So yeah. I'm a dealer for earth ponds, you know, and this whole thing isn't meant to be a plug for it, but I don't even mention that until we present the plan, because I don't want to walk into that and be like, well, I think we need at least 5 water holes across this property. Like, no, let's look at this pinch point. Does it matter? You know, and again, I look at all those factors with human intrusion. So to make a long response slightly shorter, I guess what I look at is specifically, I like those ponds in pinch points that are adjacent to, but in cover, adjacent to bedding areas and or food sources. I mean, like a dynamite textbook setup that I just love to create wherever possible is, you know, you've got a bedding area over here, and then you have the food source over there, right? Classic transition setup between point A and point B, but it's a good pinch point, and there's enough cover where we can set up a tree stand where we're kind of looking and hunting, like maybe the blind edge of that food plot. You know, if they're coming up a hill or coming out of the woods, we're hunting the very end of that food plot, but at the same time we're looking into cover, that trail leading up into cover, because I can't tell you how many times I've watched mature bucks stand inside of cover and monitor an ambush site, like a big open water source or a big food plot or even a bedding area, right? Even a bedding area that they're very sensitive when they approach it, they move in very slowly, they circle around, do the old J hook, right? But so many times, and I tell those stories to clients all the time, because I try to only base my consulting on my direct experiences, and then try to put some sort of logic or science behind why that thing did that thing, so that we can replicate, you know, as much as possible on the next property. So I love those setups where it's a small watering hole in a pinch point. It's not a super tight pinch point, but, you know, by me, a lot of times those pinches are created by the topography. So you have like a kind of a drainage. You're at the head of that drainage, which works out well. You put that pond just off to the side, so it's not picking up the primary volume of water, but a little bit of that water is going into it. And then, you know, then we don't have to worry about washing out, but those deer kind of pinch down. And again, my like ideal version of one of those setups is a mock scrape, or a lot of times there'll be a scrape in an area like that. And then a watering hole. And then the camera can be set up where it's kind of looking at both of those. So you're doubling the amount of potential for an animal to be triggered on that camera, as far as like inventory goes and just, you know, census. But, you know, the animal comes to that pinch point, they're checking the scrape, they're grabbing a drink of water. You know, both of those are opportunities to get a shot in on them if you're in the tree stand and you want to capitalize on that. So that's option A. That's like the main type of setup I look for. But with the other things, on the other side of that, like with a bigger pond, we'd be like on the edge of a food plot, but not in the food plot, like north facing tree line. So it's in the shade all the time. And then even then I'm planting shrubs around two sides of it. So I'm doing two things. I'm trying to create more cover around that, but I'm also trying to get those deer to drink out of one side of it so that you're set up for a shot opportunity.
Listen, there's really two big pieces. No ponds and food plots.
I cannot advocate.
And what do we see? Our competitors, right? You and I, competitors in the marketplace. How many ponds do you see in their designs of food plots? They're missing the boat. I mentioned earlier behavioral ecology, you know, landscape of fear, those type of principles in design. They're not taking, and these are science-based people, supposedly. They're not taking those principles and applying those to landscape features that we see, you and I see, right? You and I see the same thing. I also like the idea, and this is what I'm advocating for, and I said this in the podcast, is when you hydrate the water system or hydrate the soil around the water system, you're getting plants with usually high functionality. And high functionality is going to drive higher interest in those locations in combination with the cover that you just mentioned. Any shrubs that you like to use? I mean, maybe just a shrub or two that might just float to the top for you?
I mean, absolutely. Willows and dogwoods are pretty dynamite in those areas, right? I mean, that's kind of the go-to. And even the dogwoods, because they, you know, the rate of meristematic growth as far as like the regrowth regen on them every year is huge. And the willows are obviously the same situation. But, you know, that is what I would say is the downside of any drop-in pond liner, any type of water hole like that, is you don't create that full system. You create a water hole. That's what you create. Now I am actually like playing around with a little bit of dropping a basket with actual aquatic plants into these ponds if they are out in the edges. But you know, there's challenges with that too, because you need so much sunlight in those areas, and most of the time we're trying to keep them buried. And again, those I don't worry so much about. If you clean them out once a year, you get, you know, usually they're pretty good. They don't get nasty, mucky. You don't get like the nasty, and they don't, you know, the way that those ponds are designed specifically to not create, I think they refer to it as a no mud edge, right? So it doesn't create that environment where you have EHD midge hatch issues. But again, the only downside of them is it is a limited volume of water. And at some point you either have to go fill that up or you have to engineer your landscape to push water into that at some level. So,
and in those designs, the shallowness of them would maybe be more conducive to having kind of like that, like you said, kind of water off the landscape kind of seeping.
Yeah, that, and also, you know, the design of them, they're tapered. So the surface area of them is much greater than a straight walled tub, right? So, yeah, I was actually kind of nerding out yesterday. I walked down, grabbed the mail. It's been raining here nonstop. I've got a whole trailer load of ponds that just got delivered last week that most are going out on client properties, but it rained like a quarter of inch and the top pond in every one of those stacks was overflowing at that point. I mean, they're tipped on a hill a little bit, so it's not the full volume, but with that little bit of rain, it captured enough that it completely filled up those ponds. If you drop it in the ground, you know, you can look at it and do some simple math too, as far as like square footage. Like, well, if I do go 10 feet that way, and I go 10 feet that way, and this hill goes up that far, like there is the capacity to collect this much water during a rain event. So, you know, we look at those things, but I want to back up. So there's a couple things that I want to touch on quick with that. And this is really the whole point of why I texted you the other night about this, because a big pond, again, with utility, all those things make perfect sense to me. But I think a lot of whitetail guys that listen to this, you know, Midwestern whitetail guys, especially like, you know, in Iowa, Illinois, and it's becoming more common up here, they're putting in these like sediment type ponds, right? Like they're catching, all they're doing is catching runoff off the greater landscape. And I think the bigger issues there, one, that's a big area. And then they're all hunting over them. So it is essentially, this is like the pond and the food plot, right? Or like you see it on everyone. And again, like here's the reason why is it's the industry trying to sell you shit. Some idea, whatever it might be. And a pond in a food plot looks a whole lot better when you can take a picture of a pond and have the food plot in the background. And maybe you even get a shot of a deer over the pond with the food plot in the background. And maybe there's a box by in the background that you're trying to plug, you know, whatever it might be. I think that's the biggest part of it. But ultimately, like I've got a couple of clients where we put these ponds, these earth ponds in, and they're like, well, why do I need that? I've got six ponds across the property. I said, how often are you on stand and you actually watch a mature deer drink out of that pond? Well, I guess I can't say I ever have. Maybe once or twice during the rut, they push a doe into a pond or something like that, right? So we can prove, I've proved them before where we go and we drop an earth pond in, back in cover 50 yards off that pond on the trail system or the corridor leading into that food plot. And that's where all the deer stop and drink before they enter that food plot, right? So I think that's one utility there. But ultimately what I was going to say with that is if you're a listener and you have one of these bigger ponds, you need to convert that pond into an aquatic ecosystem instead of looking at it as a thing that captures rainwater on the landscape and then is groomed with clover planted all around it, right? You need aquatic plants. You got to get things working in there because those aquatic plants are the things that are supporting the aquatic bacteria that improve the water. Not spraying glyphosate right up to the damn pond edge so that you can get clover to grow there because you think clover is the best ground cover by your pond, right? So if guys spent more time looking at that pond, like you said, as this water resource that provides more opportunity for higher quality forage, then they would have more attraction around that pond. And with that, you know, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, hey, food plus cover equals habitat. Good quality native vegetation generally provides very good food and very good cover. So if we take these ponds and wrap them in a lot of good native aquatic plants and wet loving seasonally wet or whatever shrubs, then we get a lot more food and cover. Those deer will use that a lot more. Right. So again, you can look at it from multiple angles there.
Yeah. I mean, all good points. And I think it's thinking more holistically, like we always seem to kind of conclude on looking at each element of your design is an ecosystem that needs to function properly. Clean water is a big.
All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the burger perfection flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF, for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.
Big piece of this. When you have dirty water, you have dirty results. And you know, I've mentioned a lot of stuff on products recently on my socials because I've decided not to be tied to anybody. And I'm actually getting a earth blind pond from you. I'm getting two of them. We've decided we're going to install two of them. So I can try them out. And I've put in ponds for years. I've not used the earth blind. And I think the cool part about those earth ponds is I do like the shape of them. I like how they're contoured. I don't like these deep kind of crevice ponds. And I think, or at least liners or systems like that. So I think from a utility or maintenance standpoint, it's really a better option compared to anything else in the market. People keep asking me, what box blinds do you use? What's this that you're using? Listen, my life isn't product driven, and I'm just telling you what I'm going to do because what I see on the landscape, I'm not sponsored by Earth Ponds. I'm not sponsored by Banks Blinds. I'm not sponsored by any of these companies, which gives me that independence to really talk trash about things that don't make sense. And there's products right now that are on the marketplace that are in all your feeds, your social feeds that are garbage.
Yeah.
Absolute garbage. And I'll stop there because I don't want to name any names, but are garbage. And if you follow me on socials, I'll start listing those out because they're shorts. They just pop up. This product sucks. Here's the products I'm going to use. I'm going to start saying stuff like that.
No,
what are they going to do?
Well, I think, right? You know, again, this is one of those areas of in my life and in daily occurrence where I do struggle with that because I don't like pushing products. I don't want to be tied to products. My loyalty in the industry is with people, not the product. Right. And that's where like you learn over the years, like, you know, these people are doing this because they want to serve the industry. They want to create a product that makes things better. And it's not just a gimmick or a way to move, you know, the needle on their side of things. But with the ponds, what we talked about with improving ponds with more aquatic ecosystem approach, I would much rather stick some time and some thought into that than go down this rabbit hole of having to treat my pond all the time.
Yeah.
So that I have better water quality, right? It's the same concept really for me. It's the same concept as like herbicide use on the landscape. You know, when you look at herbicide from a land management standpoint, where herbicide can be utilized as a medicine to fix the system, right? But if it's used habitually or routinely, then it's just abuse, right? Now you're using it because it's convenience and there are going to be negative effects from that because that system can't handle that type of disturbance over and over and over again versus, you know, that pharmaceutical intervention where it's like, hey, we're going to treat this. We're going to give you a steroid injection to reduce the inflammation. And then your body can start addressing things the way it's supposed to again. Or, you know, maybe we bring in some supplementation for a couple of years and get you going. But really, if you want to be the healthiest that you can be, your body needs to figure this stuff out. And we need to provide it with adequate nutrients through the forages or through the food that you're consuming. You're not a deer. You're not ruminating on forages, but you know, ultimately it's the same with our deer. It's like, do we want our deer to rely on you going out and dumping in this three-step process so that you don't have dead water and then you don't have dead deer? And then at the same time, do we want your deer to rely on you coming out a couple times a year to fill up a mineral lick so that they can go lick rocks out of a murky hole in the ground? And do we want our deer to rely on you coming out and filling up your corn feeder and all the shit that comes with it? Or do we want to start getting back to creating these ecosystems that are abundant? And when we have these pond ecosystems or any riparian system around a wet area that's not completely smothered in reed canary grass or not completely smothered in alder buckthorn or whatever wetland shrub is overrunning that, phragmites, whatever it might be.
Right.
And then we promote native biodiversity. Then with that, if the midge shows up at any point in time, but not even the midge, maybe just the mosquitoes or other biting flies or whatever it might be, we already have this army of defenders there. The property I was just on, it was funny. The guys are like, our dad loves purple martins. And you could tell, as evident by the acre of purple martin colonies that he's got in the backyard, right? Are you familiar with purple martins? The ones like, they build the big houses, you know, like the hotels, whatever, like the gourds and shit. And he's like, so, you know, this property is really flat. They did a big tree planting on it many, many years ago. But you know, now it's at the point where it's all closed canopy and there's not a whole lot of wildlife value. So as I'm talking through, like, well, we need to open this up dramatically. We need to do these things. Like, well, if you can convince my dad that this is going to help the purple martin colony, he'll be all for it. I was like, well, that's easy. That's easy because purple martins feed entirely on flying insects. And how do we increase the amount of flying insects on a property? We increase the amount of plant diversity on a property. Specifically, we want flowering plants. And if we have flowering plants, most of these are highly palatable forbs to deer. So this is a really simple loop that we can close here that's going to make your deer hunting better. Your purple martin colonies are going to explode. They're going to absolutely explode. And the health of your deer are going to be better. And you're not going to have to deal with EHD issues around these ponds on your property because of that. Right. So again, it's like, it's full circle, full ecosystem. But again, we have to shift the mentality. It's all product driven. You know, again, it's like, well, if I can sell you convenience and that convenience is this one or this three-step process, then I'm going to get you to buy into that. And once you start doing that, then it becomes part of your routine. You're like, well, you know, I like what John and Thomas are talking about, but I don't know where to find aquatic plants. And this guy tells me exactly where to buy his product. I just click the shop now button on my Instagram feed and my problems are solved for at least 30 days or however often you're supposed to treat it. I don't know. But you know, that's the thing, is just looking at it from the big picture. And that, the same with the pond. It's like, you know, a 120 gallon earth pond is not, it's not taking the place of a 25,000 gallon pond that you're creating, right?
So, and to be honest with you, my pond, the way it's designed, it is designed to eventually be ripped out if I decide not to keep it in there. It's not, usually I would terrace the ponds and I would have like structure. I didn't do any of that. I want it almost completely as a temporary reservoir. System.
Yeah, more of a reservoir,
like right now. Yeah. And you know, the beauty of kind of that design was, you know, the dam that I put in creates structure, which creates holdability or hiding of deer in a location. So the deer are bedded adjacent to the pond. And, you know, I've already seen them up on the bank and walking around. I've already got the information. Oh, they like the pond and everything like that. But again, you know, in your design, you can kind of evolve your thinking and say, hey, I want this to be a true ecosystem. I've got other ponds that I'm starting to like reframe them. Super clean water. It's all drinkable. Anybody that comes out to the habitat day, they want to drink water on my ponds. You drink all the water on my streams. It's all potable water. And it's just having these clean ecosystems, and clean ecosystems start with good practices, which may, I like your term medicine. I don't have the ability to burn. So you know what, instead of pulling and grabbing, I may have to do a quick fix and spray some herbicide, but those are in limited times and limited locations. And you'll see the problems. There's problems on my property because I'm unwilling to either put in the work in certain ways, and I'm not willing to use herbicide in certain ways. So things are existing in imperfection, and it's being okay with those imperfect situations where you don't have to be like that weekend land manager that goes out and just literally spray. I'm not talking about the person. I'm just saying the guy that goes out and sprays everything. Like, yeah. You know, I would cancel that person. I would cancel them. There's a bunch of people I will cancel in my world. And it's just because they just don't have good ecological practices. And if you don't, you're just depleting resources in a negative way, toxifying the landscape to an ultimate potential. And actually, I will say this. Some of the people that we look up to in this industry, and I've been on my high horse about other people recently, their practices are employed at such a parochial level, at a very basic, unsubscribed level, that you have bought into bad practices on spraying 2 quarts of glyphosate 2 or 3 times a year. I'm not saying we should shoot those people, but that is not a practice that's sustainable. Now, what do you have? You have Roundup resistant plants across an entire demographic, and people are calling me, how do I fix pigweed? How do I fix the pigweed issue on my property? Right?
Yeah.
Well, we got to fix soil, right? And it doesn't start with a chemical. And that's the one thing that's, we're getting off track, but those are the things that start to really bother me as somebody who's trying to steward positivity in this world. And it's not fighting the people, it's fighting the ideology and their lack of education and just not being sensible about things that we should be more sensible about.
It's all about, yeah. I mean, again, that's the marketability of any process, is how convenient, how easy it is. And also with that, how easy it is to understand. And if you tell me that all you gotta do is buy this and spray that, I'm in. Now, yeah. If you told me that by buying that and spraying that, you know, I'm degrading the soil biology, I'm reducing diversity on the property, I'm also more than likely absorbing some level of that into my body. And depending on what the chemical is and how it reacts with the chemistry of my body, it might just be building in my bone marrow. It might just be consolidating in my brain tissue. You know, there's a lot of things that go with it, and it's not, you know, it's funny, but it's not, right? I mean, so like, that's the other thing, is like, let's just take a look for a second, and then I'm going to get off this high horse. I do have one more question for you before we wrap this up, but let's just take a look for a second and look around. From land use practices alone, have things gotten better? Is the quality of life, the length of life from kids all the way up to retirement and our senior citizens, is that getting better or is it getting worse? Right? And where is the money in that process? Where is that money being made from the industries that are promoting the current practices? Right? So again, if it is just simply you're doing what you're doing because that's what you know, I understand that.
So do I.
But there are plenty of alternatives, and that's where you have to just have an open mind. And at some point, everyone looks at it from a different perspective. You know, for me, largely it was when I had kids. And then all of a sudden you're like, I want to make sure I'm doing what's best for them. I don't want to expose them to the same things that I was potentially exposed to, whatever it might be. And then your brain shifts and you start doing things different ways. And maybe that way takes a little bit more time, a little bit more planning, potentially even a little bit more expense because we've made things so cheap. You know, the chemicals are so cheap these days. So I'll say that. But my question for you is back to the pond thing, the utility of it. And I think where you're going with this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the potential of having that pond there as a water source to irrigate that food plot has the potential or the capacity to help you improve the soil and biology in that location. So long term, you don't necessarily need to irrigate once you build biology, build organic matter, and improve that soil and get that system turned on, right?
Yeah, okay, exactly.
The reason I bring that up is because I'm working with a client in Central Texas right now that we've got this property to the point where, you know, for him to really move the needle on it as far as like increasing potential on the property, he has to improve forage quality, right? Has to improve it. These are the conversations I have with these types of clients right out of the gate is, yes, I understand that you have 8 feeders across this property, and that's pretty common practice in Texas, and it's pretty common practice in Ohio, right? The question for the landowner is, do you want to actually increase the potential of that property? And do you want to increase that potential while improving your management efficiency via reducing your costs of supplemental feed versus what you're putting into the ground and managing for a more permanent or sustainable system? And obviously the answer is always the latter. Yeah, I'd rather stick more money into that. You know, the conversation the other day was, I think you should buy a no-till drill, because if you're going to plant 20 acres of food plots every year, it's going to be way cheaper for you to own your own drill than to pay someone to come in with a drill. And ultimately, what's the cost of that drill versus how much you're putting into feed every year? And then second question is, how often are you seeing mature bucks on the feeders, relatively speaking? Not very often. So
I have an argument here that I think is really helpful for people. And I think it's around the feeder topic.
Well, let me finish this real quick before I lose my train of thought. So ultimately, forage quality, and why I was asking this is because their current food plot on the property in the center of the property, which I think actually sets up well from an access standpoint and an anchor standpoint, that current food plot has I can't remember exactly, but I want to say about a 1 acre to 3/4 acre pond/reservoir located on the hill about 15 feet higher in elevation from where this food plot area is. And the whole time I'm like, we're going to design this where we can use that pond to improve this area. So sure. I'm curious, and this is maybe we can go down a whole nother rabbit hole in this, but I'm curious what you're using for like a trash pump and how you're setting that up to if you're just doing a flood system or what, but what were you going to say?
So two parts. I'm going to go back to the feeder thing real quick, because this is something I just advise a client on. So this is a client. It wasn't a client for this. Remember, I did that big job. I redid one of Higgins' properties. This is a different client. It's doing feeders. Okay. And what I told him was the supplemental feeding that you're using as a foundation to attract deer, but also feed deer, is degrading their forage intake to the point where it's offsetting the quality food that you have in your landscape. And they're actually eating lower value food by eating your Maximizer Plus or whatever product that people are using.
Filling up on a bag of potato chips, corn-based potato chips from the grocery store or from the gas station is taking the place of higher quality food I could be getting elsewhere, right? Like, it's the same thing, is it not?
It is. It is. And so that nutrient deficiency that you're creating because of the supplemental feeding, and then this is the negative, right? So all these guys are doing like farming for deer. I'm in the wildlife ecology side of the house, but you know, you're seeing that actually the quality of animals going down. Now people are saying, oh, there's been this study and blah, 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 that, you know, antler increase over X amount of years is 10%. Well, what if the quality of forage, which is, you know, primary part of their diet, you increase the forage quality, the nutrient density in those plants great enough at a large enough landscape scale that maybe the antler growth could be 20 inches greater as compared to your supplemental food resource, which actually has, you know, probably only a quarter of the value of the local forage. And the other piece of it is in these water stressed areas where you have a lot of drought, those immediate forage resources in those locations are typically depleted at a pretty significant click if you don't have a balance of forest strata. So a lot of different forest plants in those landscapes balancing moisture, vegetation, CO2, all the thing around those plants. So you got to be very predictive in how you kind of lay out these features where you use the trees and the shrubs, the understory plants to kind of cohabitate and co-evolve. So your forage quality will go up with a variety of trees. So just clear cutting an area is actually starting, I'm starting to realize, and I think people are starting to realize, that's actually a pretty bad practice when it comes to increasing forage quality. So I'm suggesting clear cut minimal quantities, stop using any type of supplemental feed, none, zero whatsoever, and then increase water content by what we're just about to talk about. So water resources on the landscape. So I have one, do you have clean water? That's your first thing that you have to answer. Go get your water tested. And it's going to vary. It's coming out of a stream. It's going to vary. But relatively speaking, you have clean water. That's critical for this. There's a lot of good mineral content in clean water. Iodine is one of those things. There's a lot of things that benefit the plants in across those particular areas. Clean water. How you take that water is, you know, you've seen pivots on the landscape. There's a lot of different options that people have. So I have a small trash pump. It's a WX15 Honda pump. It's just small. It's got two handles, probably $500 to $600. I've got a 150 foot heavy hose line, almost like fire hose style. And then I have like a 20-25, you know, it's an intake tube with a filter on the end of it. And all I have, it's really simple, is I have a giant sprinkler. It is a just big sprinkler. It's pretty heavy duty. And it shoots based on that pump. I can shoot 150 foot in a circle. That's pretty significant. So basically in my food plot, and I don't think I'll run it the day you're there. I might run it. I'll run it so people can see it running. Here's the other cool part on my property. So I want to say a 25 degree decline, and I can shoot right adjacent to that is my food forest system. So I can shoot all across, and the sprinklers are awesome because you can limit what areas they shoot. And so the objective is to increase forage quality by increase the water availability to plants. And that increases nutrient cycling. It increases biology. Microorganisms function in those conditions. And so if you have water stress areas and you minimize that, you're in really, really great shape.
What happens to the overflow of your pond? Where's that going?
I just have a small spillway, and the slope is incorrect for the spillway. So I'm going to be, when we're there, I'll talk about all the bad things that I did wrong. You want really kind of like a 2-to-1 slope. I got like a 5-to-1 slope. It's not good.
It's steeper than what you want. It's, you're saying.
It's just going to spill into this area. That area is going to eventually get inundated. Actually, I'm going to dig out like a small little streamway. The beauty of what I have is I have gravelly loamy soil. So I couldn't be in a better situation when it comes to, you know, infiltration. I have really good infiltration, and that's why you'll see I use the liner. And I made some mistakes, even in this pond, and I've done multiple ponds. Like, I'm not a pond expert, but I've built a lot of ponds. And I'll explain everything I did right and everything I did wrong. And that's the beauty of kind of seeing it on the landscape.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to have you out here. You get to see New York, spend some time. You get to spend some time at my house.
I guess not to throw a plug, but if anyone in New York wants a 120 or 80 gallon earth pond, I'm bringing a pickup truck load full of them out there. So,
yeah, and you're more than welcome. If you want, reach out to me or reach out to Thomas. I mean, I'm getting a couple. Yeah, we didn't want to make this all about selling stuff.
No, definitely not. But certainly if you've got it on your project list for this year, I mean, that's, you know, logistics can be a problem with anything in those ponds. That's like the downside of them is it costs a lot to ship.
And
there's not many dealers out there that have them these days. I think they're, once the word gets out, be a little bit different story. But ultimately, if you're looking to get a pond and you want one, I mean, you don't have to pay shipping on anything. And they do have the craziest thing, I think, with something like that, not the craziest thing, but an advantage of them is they do have a lifetime warranty. And there's like kind of no things that can go wrong with them. The only problem I've ever had with one was a client shot through a deer and put a hole in it. And They
just,
patch it. I mean, a fiberglass patch on the backside, and it's not a problem. But other than that, lifetime warranty on them. So, you know, if you're looking for that small drop-in water hole solution, I don't think it gets a whole lot better. But
no, that's awesome. And I'll mention to the folks that are here that day, so they know that you're maybe you'll have a couple extra available to those folks. So we'll see what we can do. But yeah, if anybody's interested, reach out. If you don't participate in the Habitat Day, you can't come. But if you want some ponds, we can probably make it happen through Thomas. So, no, that's all good. Hey, man, thanks for taking time with me. It's been a while. We've sporadically been talking, but I haven't had you back on here. Hopefully, we can do a couple more of these. I've got a pretty cool podcast that's going to come out that I'll be working on here next week about dealing with invasive plants and the thought behind how invasives are bad and good in the same respect. So I'm trying to give people different perspectives on things. So a lot of this has been communication between you and me, and just trying to think about at a really high level, you know, being smart about how we approach kind of these systems. And I think you laid out a ton of stuff on here today. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem at all. As always, I appreciate you having me on.
All right. We'll talk again soon.
Take care.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.